Welcome to January 1944, the episode I think that many of our listeners have been waiting for, the true start of the Howling Commandos, right, Liv?
Yeah, some of my friends said that their abridged versions of the book actually started with January 1944 instead of July 1943. Because, you know, that's like when they started beating up Nazis for real.
Didn't you also say that you'd found an audiobook version that left out the earlier months, too?
They weren't left out completely, just sort of edited, which is why Anyways, we've gotten some great comments from the listeners talking about how glad they are that we're making a complete audio version of The Night War.
That's right. People have been very thoughtful in reaching out to us at thenightwar.com, and we've done our best to answer most of those questions on the website.
I thought it might be more fun if we did some of them on the show.
So what's the first question?
Okay, so we answered a couple of these already, but this one I thought was kind of perfect to put in an episode. It's from Anonymous, very catchy, and how about you read it?
Sure, here it is. Is there anything you can tell us about the real Bucky Barnes? Not just what we all know from the book, but things based on real recollections from his or your family? It's a great question.
Yeah, so the way I read it was they want to know, like, family legend kind of stuff, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, like, definitely family stories and stuff like that that gets passed around. And there's going to be some letters. Actually, Auntie Becca just found more for me. But anyways, we thought it'd be more fun to go straight to the source instead.
Hard-nosed detective style.
Yeah. So, listeners, stay tuned, because I'm going to get the dirt and report back what some of the people who knew Bucky best have to say.
Including?
Mr. Frank Castellano.
That's right. We're very lucky here at the Audio Companion to have the very generous support of the Able to Help Foundation, which Frank founded all the way back in 1963, with the simple motto, "We can help, so we do."
Over the last 50 years, the Able to Help Foundation has raised millions of dollars to support the families of veterans. With the help of listeners like you, the Able to Help team sends the children of active duty military personnel to arts and enrichment programs, summer camps, and even college.
And you can go to thenightwar.com for more information.
And next week, I'm going to be talking to Mr. Castellano, who agreed to be interviewed on the show, even though, now see here, Missy, I never even read that damn book.
I'm pretty sure he said that in just about every interview he's ever done.
Yeah, probably. He's like the only person left by now who hasn't read it. So anyways, yeah, we're going to talk a bit about the Able to Help Foundation and...
And about being a total babe in World War II.
Oh my God.
Next time, Frank Castellano will join us to talk Able to Help and his friendship with Bucky Barnes. This week, we return to Operation Bonfire, a grueling mission deep behind enemy lines that set the stage for the Allies' remarkable Heracles campaign against the SS research service known as Hydra.
Ooh, spooky. Hydra.
To the front day and night, where the doughboys dig and fight, and those caissons go rolling along. Our barrage will be there, fire it on the rocket's flare, while those caissons go rolling along.
For it's high,
heat
in the field artillery.
Call off your numbers loud and strong.
One, two, three, four.
For wherever we go, you will always know that those caissons are rolling along.
Keep them rolling.
That those caissons are rolling along.
January 3rd. Assaulted the objective yesterday, and it was a success. Total element of surprise, and they were undermanned and unprepared for assault. Those miserable fucking weeks at the rock pile, now worth it. And Fallsworth doesn't have to say a word, but I swear to God he lights his cigarette as smug as anyone could ever light a smoke. I wonder how he's got to this point in his life without more broken noses. Betsy performed beautifully. Steve looks like goddamn Achilles out there, like he thinks he's invincible because he has a magic fucking shield. Stupid shit. I had scouting duty along with Dernier, so he could prepare his bit. It all went to mostly plan, except for taking longer than expected. Never has that been said in all my months at war. I must be stuck in a dream of Fallsworth's and not know it. Now, the hard part begins, especially as we ran out of gasoline for the crowd trucks we stole. Morita on the radio has been keeping track of the Fifth Army's movements, so we should be able to link up. But the goddamn Kraut line, who knows which one, they are endless, is holding fast, and we are just 7 men, not the first armored, though they may well think we are, with as much noise as Steve makes stomping around. January 6th. Second day in this fucking storm. No movement possible, and we are low on rations. First time in 2 days my hands warm enough to hold my pencil since we have gotten better at keeping the fire going. Thank God for Jim Morta. Whoever thought I would be grateful for dry brush that will burn at least a little. In Brooklyn, I don't even think I knew what dry brush was. Wish I still did not. Morta says people go camping for fun in California. I will take a dame to the park for fun, but that is it. Even with the fire, my hands are shaken, but I think it is hunger, not cold. Seems like K-rations do nothing at all. I eat all of it in a minute flat, fast enough to make Fallsworth's face cramp up, he's so disgusted at my manners, and as soon as it's gone, it is as though it has disappeared from everywhere, including my stomach. It is bad enough that even drinking our shit coffee gives me the shakes, and that is not all right, considering I must have a steady hand for my rifle among all of us. God, I am fucking hungry. What I wouldn't give for one of Ma's breads, or a burger from Delancey's and an egg cream, and even Curly's cookies she made a few years ago for my birthday that I nearly choked on. God, I would eat a dozen of those cookies now. They had about a pound of cinnamon in them at least. I have no idea how she found the money for all of it. And a Coke, a cold Coke and a bag of licorice after work with Steve at Rita Hurley's folks' corner store. And then maybe take some dames out and have beers and go to a Horn and Hardhearts after. I would take every nickel I have and eat the entire automat right now if I could. I swear to God I would kiss Steve's ma for one of her awful corned beef sandwiches she made when she forgot about the corned beef because someone called on her to take a shift. I think I'd eat 10 of them. I think writing about it is making it worse. January 7th. Storm cleared and we made up some ground. Found a farmhouse with nobody in it and snow all inside. Dernier found some potatoes and carrots and 3 jars of tomatoes in the root cellar and made a stew. Supposedly the French can cook, but Dernier at least cannot. He says it was no good because there was no red wine in it. Personally, I think it was no good because there was no salt, and he possibly did not get the dirt off the potatoes. But it didn't matter, of course. We ate it all and were grateful as hell for it. Funny part is Jones found 2 bottles of wine an hour later, and Dernier turned up his nose because they were Italian. Well, me, Dugan, Morta, Fallsworth, and Jones did not. And then Dernier didn't either. I thought maybe if I could get a little drunk, then for a minute or two I could make myself think I was at home, sitting next to Curly in front of the fireplace with her reading to me, and Ma making real coffee in the kitchen, and Pop trying to ignore Jack and Teddy wrestling, like when they were kids, and not anywhere near here, not in a uniform, and nobody giving them a gun. But I didn't get drunk. There wasn't enough. January 9th. Finally connected with the 45th, and gave Jerry a little hell when we did. Took out some Artie in armor, and nearly got our head shot off by our own guys when we crossed the line. Kraus got real confused after that, and even though we were low on ammo, we stuck around a little to help the boys out. Somebody had to work in radio since Jim's took a bullet, and so we made contact with command after, and Steve made his report, which I laughed at him for. Should have seen his face get serious and his voice all like he was a real tough guy, a regular Jimmy Cagney. We met with the local brass, too, and I guess the fellows in the foxholes made a real impression on Steve, since he went again and volunteered us to stay. That is what he told us, anyhow, but I think the fool bird he spoke to was just savvy enough to make Steve think it was his idea. They have good supplies here, though, so, and some tents, and we have at least a day before we go back out. So am going to try and sleep and sleep and sleep if I can, and eat in between. I have to say I did not expect to be back in woods and mountains on the line again, and I cannot help but think of Fanafro, but it will not be the same. It cannot possibly be the same. We know what we are facing here, as we just cracked through the line in the other direction, so it will not be the same. January 11th. Steve has never fought in a foxhole before, but that is where we are now. Fucking Krauts have a crack shot over the line somewhere, and Steve has a giant fucking target on his chest, and I will not let him get up from this foxhole, forget that he is the CO, the stupid self-sacrificing shit. It is cold as hell, and I'm doing all I can to keep my hands warm, at least so they do not shake Betsy. I shot 2 Krauts yesterday, and Steve saw... And before it has been in his immediate defense, not in cold blood across the line where they were only having a smoke. I would rather me do it instead of him having to, but damn do I hate him seeing what it takes and what this war is like. I am giving myself one smoke before going out, because I cannot hold Steve for long, and there's a good shot out there who needs to meet a better one. January 12th. Steve and me helped get a man back behind the line to a dock, but really it was Steve, as I was covering us. Poor bastard had his guts half out and he was screaming, and I knew he was dead, but Steve didn't, and by the time we got to the dock, he wasn't even screaming anymore. Steve, I do not think, has seen one of our own die like that before. He smoked through half my ration and told me he could have gone faster, should have gone faster. And the poor stupid punk always did think it was always all on him, didn't he? I don't know how to help him through, because I have seen enough men die, and it does not get easier at all. In fact, all I could see was Harry, and it was enough to make me feel like I was dying myself. January 14th. On a Liberator converted to a transport plane, headed back for jolly old England. Command, not exactly delighted that Steve went and improvised our staying on the line, but the colonel has sent along a letter describing how his men's morale has never been higher, which I know to be a load of horseshit. Though watching Steve charge a tank and bust up its turret with a goddamn shield is a hell of a sight, even if it gave me enough heart attacks for a lifetime. Plain too cold to sleep, even though I feel like I haven't slept in days. I remember when Mom was pregnant with Curly. I guess I was real worried because I didn't see how any new baby could be as great as Ted and Jack. She said to me, "Beloved, remember this. Love is the one thing you can never run out of." Well, on the battlefield is a strange time to think of that, but it came to mind after our little platoon was off the line and eating some hot chow. Tired as hell and quiet, but all of us alive in no small part thanks to each other. I guess a part of me has been thinking all along, these jokers will never be a real unit. Not a one of them except Steve could stand shoulder to shoulder with Harry and Tally and Glenn and Lipsy. But as it turns out, there are always more good men to be found. Though we are an odd lot, they can all be counted on. And if I have learned anything, that's all that matters. January 15th. Billeted in London in a very swell house on Grosvenor Street. Apparently it has been requisitioned for the war effort and its owner skipped off to their other house in the country. I cannot imagine even owning a whole house, much less two of them. I remember when we moved into our apartment with three bedrooms when Curly was eight or so, and she asked me, so seriously, "Bucky, are we rich now?" Ha, what a laugh. Although, if things go south for me here, I have written Ma to use the death benefit for a house. So maybe I will own a house one day after all. Anyhow, Steve has been assigned his own room as Captain America, and the rest of us are doubled up. Me with Jones, Dernier with Dugan, because Falsworth flat out refused to share with the frog. Steve was dead embarrassed about getting his own billet like that. He's embarrassed about the captain stuff in general, but there's a reason I've followed him around my entire life, isn't there? Anyhow, I told him to knock it off and to make sure he kept the place clean for his best girl. And he popped me one that actually hurt a little. Anyway, it is strange to have a place where your footlocker stays put. Stranger still that 2 days ago we were on the line, and now we are getting asked if we care for any tea and eggs and bacon. You get used to being at the front, no matter how awful it is. But it is very disconcerting to be dragged back into civilization, and London of all places where you do feel out of place. I never felt like I didn't belong somewhere in my entire life, and Falsworth is okay after a while, but talking with these people sure reminds a man that he didn't finish the 10th grade. Mail waiting for us when we got here also. I did send Ma a letter from Aldbourne, with Teddy and my signature at the bottom. I thought she would be really delighted to know that the three of us got to have Christmas together. Christmas cards from her and Curly, and several from dames I know. According to Curly's letters, all of Brooklyn is overcome with pride about Steve. And me too, according to her. But I got eyes, and I can guess as to which one of us makes a housewife overcome with pride. Still, I guess it is not a surprise to be getting the reverse of a Dear John letter. Nothing from Margaret or the rest of Harry's family, and Bobby has not written Curly either, at least not that Curly says. It feels awful not knowing anything or how she's doing, or even what she named the babies. One of the best times we ever had was Frank Castellano getting everyone riled up on the Wabettan pool for the Miller babies. Frank organized the whole thing, and took a cut, naturally, but he's such a showman nobody minded. I think he found himself with enough smokes and blue pages to last the rest of the war after all that. And Harry played along, refusing to tell until enough guys bought in. Not until DeMarco came up with some fresh fruit, and then DeMarco won and guessed Edith, after his own mother. Then, of course, as it turns out, Harry rigged it with him the minute he heard about the fruit. Harry never misses a chance for a joke. London is loud, but a far different kind of loud than I have gotten used to. I guess the bombing here is not so bad now, and I am not exactly nervous about it, but it still feels like I'm just waiting for the shelling to start. The minute I shut my eyes, my skin starts itching. It is not that I want to be back in the field, exactly, but somehow when you have a job to do, and your pals' lives are at stake, your mind quiets down for a while, and a little quiet is all I want. January 22nd. Letter from Frank Castellano. It is the first I have directly heard from an able man. Not surprising, since most everyone is still in the hospital, or well on their way home. I do know of several who have decided to go back to the regiment. Off the top of my head, Jim Delaney and Sheehan, and also Sergeant Doherty from 1st Platoon. Anyhow, Frank writes that he is determined to go back as well. He was not too terribly injured, just very sick and malnourished, with an infection in his leg, and he says it's getting better. I feel sick to think he may go back to Able, without me and Harry and nearly all our platoon. I don't know how he could stand it. In any case, I don't know how there is a regiment left with all the bad juju around it now. But Frank did write that he heard half a 3rd Battalion was in reserve, and so they will rebuild off of that. 3 whole intact companies for an entire regiment. Frank has also gotten a promotion to tech sergeant, which is overdue in my opinion, and certainly his. He signed his letter in block capital letters and underlined sergeant 3 times. His letter did not say much other than what news he has. I think the truth of it is that while we both know that we will never see Harry or Skip again, it is unbearably awful to put that in a letter. There is no taking it back when you put that into a letter. Meanwhile, here with Dugan and Jones and the rest, we all know to keep our traps shut about our dead friends. And I don't think Steve has any real idea at all about any of it. Not that he should. He is the reason we're not all dead, after all. January 25th. SSR button heads with OSS Command and SOE and a mess of other letters about the logistics for next op. We are going to an island in Greece. I suppose writing that down would make Carter give me a hateful look. But it's not as though saying an island in Greece narrows it down much, does it? I have done enough staring at maps over the past few days to know that much. We all have ants in our pants to get going. January 27th. And here I thought parachuting into Austria was the worst idea I've ever heard. Command's idea to do a beach landing at night. Just the 7 of us, with the plan being that once we radio in, they will drop a company of airborne from the 504th PIR to support. Meanwhile, I know for a fact that the 82nd have just done a landing at Anzio, and it is fucking rotten to ask them to turn around and do it again a week later. Anyhow, I have no idea how OSS-SSR got General Clark to agree to this plan, but I am hoping he finds some sense. Though my guess is that he doesn't have much to begin with, if Salerno is anything to judge by. Harry had a joke. Infantry cry, home, 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 and Clark hears, Rome, Rome, Rome. In any case, we have enough going on in Italy that I don't think a single company of airborne is enough to start a second front in Greece, no matter what the 82nd thinks of themselves. All it will do, in my opinion, is put a hell of a lot of good men at risk, when I think if the 7 of us can just keep our heads a bit, we will do just fine. Hit the objective and get out alive. In the briefing by a Lieutenant Axiotakis, we heard about the state of Greece, and it does get your blood boiling. The estimates say thousands dead of famine because of the fucking krauts. Not soldiers or partisans dead, but mothers and children. Before we shipped, I remember talking with folks who still thought we should only be paying attention to Japan, as who cares about Europe blowing itself up? I think people at home have things too easy. How is it possible a whole country forgot what it was like going to bed hungry? I have never forgotten it. There is good and there is evil in the world, and no matter what about anyone says about the damn imperialists, there is nothing to argue when there are mothers and children starving. January 29th. SSRs change their mind after all, thank God. It will just be us. Never thought I would be happy about going into combat without reinforcements. But I can't stand to see another company get slaughtered. And if this Hydra position has half the firepower over Zano, that is what will happen. Gamzulatova.
Yeah? Hang on. You okay?
Can I... Will you talk to me?
Well, shit, am I Italian? Give me a sec. Well, alright, come on. Gonna tell old war stories, need a drink. You want any leftovers? Midnight snack? Me neither. Here, open the red. It's behind you. Corkscrews in the drawer. There you go. Yeah, just, you know, don't crush your bottle with your robot arm. No, keep screwing till the end. That's my motto. Right, now just good. Now, you pour. I'm gonna sit. So what do you want to talk about? You still listening to that, Yeah. That's a fascinating story you got there, Sarge. No, don't stop. What am I talking to you about, Buck? You said you didn't read it. No, I did not. Everybody. Not me. You asking why? Well, hell, I was there. Had enough of hearing you brag about your Belladonna, whatever the fuck. Benedetta. You remember that? It was in the book. Yeah, see, proves my point exactly. I didn't need to read it. Dear Diary, looks like my friend Frank's a real pal. I owe him a couple of smokes, except not the ones I smoke, because they are the god-awfulest shit.
It doesn't say that.
Well, it should. Your choice in smoke somehow got worse over the years. Goddamn.
But...
What?
Why?
The truth? Well, here, give me one of those. The truth is, Sarge, that I was sad. And that diary was your own private business, and I couldn't stand the thought of reading it, even if everybody else and their fucking mother was.
It doesn't... It doesn't feel like I wrote it. I can't remember, Frank. I can't...
Easy.
It's here, but I can't... It's got everything, and everybody saw.
You don't gotta read it, Sarge.
Listening.
That either.
But I gotta remember. It's all there.
Fuck that. No, it is not.
Letter my mother wrote.
Yeah, and that's a fucking tragedy, Sarge.
It is.
But it's all there? No. You're all here. Don't shake your head at me. I'm older than you.
Look it.
Yes, I do.
I don't...
What?
I don't remember you.
My condolences.
But
don't you say what I think you're gonna say, kid. Whether or not somebody remembers you ain't got shit to do with whether you care about them. I had a wife and 6 years of learning that lesson with her. Got that?
Okay.
Oh, Jesus Christ, it's fucking late. Sorry, I woke you up. Do you need... You know, I had a non-com in the war who went around every night checking in on everybody. You got your blanket, you got your ammo. Most annoying goddamn thing in my entire fucking life. What happened to him? I'm looking at him. I'm going to bed. You get some rest, Buck.